Welcome back to the University of Illinois Press podcast, The Upside. I am your host, Elizabeth Hess. I am joined today by Dr. Andrea Ringer, an assistant professor in the History, Political Science, Geography, and Africana Studies Department at Tennessee State University. Her latest work for the University of Illinois Press, Circus World, Roustabout, Animals, and the Work of Putting on the Big Show, is now available at the University of Illinois Press website. Dr. Ringer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Before we get into some of the details of the book, can you tell me a little bit about your education, your teaching history?
Sure. So I teach at Tennessee State University in Nashville. I got my PhD from the University of Memphis. That's where I was when I started this work. And I also come from a public history background. So what I have my master's in from UALR in Little Rock.
Other than the circus, what are some of the past topics about which you've written?
When I first started graduate school in history, I was active in the Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. I was in Arkansas. So the first few things I wrote about were prisons, and I still teach a prison class at Tennessee State University. So that's part of what I've done. As far as labor history and animals, I've written about circuses. I've written about zoos, a little bit about vaudeville. Right now I'm writing a biography of a mule here in Nashville who worked in the streetcar system and retired to the zoo.
Now let's get into the book. What was your inspiration to write about this? Your interest started in childhood, or is that more recent?
I didn't have an early interest in circuses, but I definitely did have an early interest in animals. I changed majors as an undergraduate, which I think every history major does. So I started out as a zoology major at Texas A&M. I hated the coursework. I wasn't a good fit for it. It wasn't a good fit for me. My first semester, I had a dissection every week in a biology lab. It just wasn't bringing me joy. And I realized if I continued down that path, I wasn't going to be good at my job. I wouldn't be fulfilled at my job. The best class I took as a zoology major was this writing intensive class. And I was so excited to finally be able to write papers. But then the whole course was about fruit flies. It was a little disappointing, but it was still the best course I took when I was in the sciences. So I switched to history because I felt like I was good at it. I enjoyed doing it. And I thought, maybe I'm a writer. But I was completely unaware that I could still study animals in the history field at that time. I circled back to animals via labor history. When I started my PhD, that was the first time I really started reading about and writing about and thinking about labor histories. I realized how expansive labor histories could be. And at that same time, I happened across that. It's a very famous Ringling Brothers poster. And it's just this picture of a tiger's face, a very ferocious looking tiger. And I started thinking about all the labor that maybe went behind that tiger. I started maybe thinking about that tiger as a worker and then other animals as workers as well. The first book I read in that field was Susan Nance's book, Entertaining Elephants. And that was just it for me. I had never seen an animal as centered in a history book. And it made me feel like I could write this book and maybe I should write this labor history and it was worth telling. And then before I wrote a word of the book, I wrote an article that was a much more traditional labor history of the circus in the sense that it was about unions, untraditional in the sense that it was about sideshow unions and lion tamers in unions. I published that in Labor, which is Lotch's journal. And I think writing that gave me the foundation to think through labors and identities on the lot in the book that, again, are very expansive.
Let's talk about some of the history of the circus. So from the 1870s to the 1960s, circuses were comprised of, in your words, quote, a unique workforce of human and animal laborers from around the world to put on the entertaining show. What type of people were drawn to travel and perform with the circus in the beginning?
It was a mix of expected and also sort of unexpected workers, unexpected people, a substantial group of working class, mostly young men. They were the more transient part of the workforce in the sense that they could move in and out of the show, even in a single season, sometimes by their choice, sometimes not by their choice. Circus labor also grafted onto like colonial networks. So the workforce included dozens or sometimes hundreds of people from colonized spaces. I think those were also very expected kinds of workers because shows were billing themselves as having people from all over the world. In any kind of skilled entertainment, there was, and there still is, this idea of family dynasties, people that were born into the circus world and said that very proudly. And then there were just countless stories of people running away to join the shows. They would just pick up and go when a show would come into town and kind of follow that dream. And folks that did that, they crossed all sorts of identities of class and gender. And it included people in a variety of job categories too.
A great marketing slogan, the greatest show on earth. Who is responsible for that name and what made it so unique when it debuted?
So the idea of the circus being the greatest show predates Barnum. It's associated with Dan Rice. But the Barnum show and then the Ringling Brothers show, they revolutionized so much of the circus world. But they were building on a circus world that had already been crafted. The basic categories of performance, like the equestrians, the clowns, the elephants, all those things were already part of the circus. But then those giants, Barnum and Ringling, they came in and they revolutionized lots of things. They made it bigger. They were really astute with the advertising. They advertised in really effective ways. They created multiple tents, multiple rings within the tents. This became a 5-ring circus, which is just massive to think about. I don't know that there could have been a more visually stimulating performance that people could have gone to go see. And then part of what the book traces is this merger within the circus world where most of the shows came under the Ringling banner and then all the implications that went with that. But that combined Ringling Barnum show, I think it really was probably the most spectacular performance that people had ever seen up to that point.
Let's take it back a step, and it had to get to America. This is the part that horrified me of the conditions on the boat. I cannot imagine what everyone endured getting here. Can you describe the conditions of what it was like while they were traveling overseas to get to America?
It was bleak. There was nothing glamorous on these transatlantic voyages, and animals and people too took the voyages multiple times sometimes because the shows would also go overseas. Some of the things I mentioned in the book, they strike us as very terrible animal care practices, but at the time they weren't thought to be. So I mentioned a gorilla that was fed whiskey every time he was seasick, for example, but animals in zoos were being fed whiskey all the time too, especially monkeys. You know, even people used whiskey in medicinal ways that same year. I also mentioned the death on the boat, right? Horses died on that voyage, on that first particular voyage I opened the book with. Also a giraffe named Daisy didn't make it. And if you think about the boat as a workplace, as an interspecies workplace, you know, workplaces were deadly, especially interspecies workplaces. So many working animals outside the circus as well, they were going to be worked to death. The shows actually leaned into that reality that animals worked in really dangerous conditions, and they portrayed themselves as advocates of animal care. And they portrayed their animals as being privileged among their species. We see animals that, again, are worked to death in other places, and circuses would boast that, you know, their horses actually got to retire if they survived jumping through fiery hoops. But captivity in general, it also was just full of death. It was a very unregulated place. Life expectancies were short in captivity in institutions like circuses and zoos. And those institutions were learning as they went. Because the question of let's say, Daisy the giraffe, it isn't just how do you take care of a giraffe, but how do you take care of a captive giraffe? Because that's a different living condition. How do you take care of a baby giraffe? These are questions people didn't know. How do you keep a giraffe alive on a boat? 1898, how do you know how to do these things? The circus was trying to figure it out as they went.
So it wasn't necessarily animal cruelty in that nobody intended to hurt the animals, but through dehydration or overheating. I mean, there were other ways that the animals suffered.
Again, accounts in zoo circuses, they look really similar. And animals often were thought of as kind of a martyr to science, right? To figuring out how to do this. Yeah, it was incredibly cruel from our standpoint.
Based on the hours that people worked, would you say in the initial stages that people were paid well? Were they paid moderately, or were they underpaid to travel with the circus?
It was all three. And some people at least could move between those pay categories during their career. It was another badge of honor to work your way up in the shows. Certain shows paid better than others. Ringling was the big payday during the height of the circus. You also sometimes had entire families on payrolls. That was another way that you had additional income. I have a chapter on animal trainers, and I track their labor contracts and the way that their animals were being displayed between performances. Essentially, they were leasing out their animals. So they had these other streams of income as well. Geography also impacted how people got paid. I track an elephant trainer in the book who moved between continents, and he was able to command a huge salary by doing that.
You may or may not know the answer to if women were paid more or less than men, but were women considered equals in the arena, or are they less important than men in terms of performance?
So the circus world as a whole, it was very tightly knit. It was never equal. The circus world identity that portrayed itself as equal, but that was in terms of class. On the lot, the circus owner was taking all of his meals with all of the working people in the tent. They all ate the same thing, but that identity had fault lines. So circus life looked very different for women. It looked different for Black men. It looked different for Native American families. It was a massive and a diverse workforce. And this is part of the reason we see union, such heavy union activity in the 1930s, right? This is over pay. Black workers faced a very different world. They faced dangers that other workers didn't. There's a story in the book I have about a Black circus worker who refused to take his family with him during the season. That was a privilege that workers who didn't have to contend with racially motivated violence didn't even think twice about. They just took their families with them through the South or on the route, which is why there are so many photos of babies in the book. So race was definitely one of those fault lines. And then for women in particular, the circus was a space where they worked, they collected paychecks, they embodied this emerging new woman ideal at the turn of the century, but they're also performing a second shift and working a lot. As workers, they were absolutely irreplaceable. They often were the star aerialists, the equestrians. They had jobs like the snake charmer that were carved out for them. In the book, I also talk about the behind the scenes work that women did. I back that chapter up to a chapter on animal mothers to argue that circuses were just wholly dependent on the image of mothering and also the performance of mothering in and out of the circus ring.
Not everybody wanted to be on stage, and thank goodness for that, for those who want to be backstage and stage hands. There were menial tasks. Those are the words that you used in the book that kept the show on the road. What were some of those menial tasks?
The big shows, they were a tented city. It was a mobile city that moved every day, and so you had everything you would expect in a town or a city. Workers, like I said, they brought their kids, so you would have teachers. People were performing really physical tasks in these intricate sequin costumes. And so there were seamstresses. The animals I mentioned, they needed medical care. So there was a vet. People often needed medical care. There's a doctor there. Towards the end of the book, I also explore things that I would consider mundane work, right? Folks that didn't travel with the shows, but that kept the shows running, the accountants, the lawyers, the people sitting in the boardrooms. And that version of the circus world at the end of the book is a very different version from the one at the beginning of the book when the entire show was there on the rails. And at the end, you have an entire class of workers who aren't with the shows at all.
You describe how there were people in charge that were somewhat controlling. The circus operators regulated employee behavior inside and outside the tent, even as the employees blurred the line between leisure and labor. In all parts of the show, the workers could not escape their work. Can you describe what that looks like?
Part of that regulation was done informally. The ways people got paid, for example, or the ways the pay was withheld. Some workers guessed, they probably were right, but that pay would sometimes get withheld to keep workers on the lot to sort of control their behavior. There are also very formal ways that behavior was regulated. There was a police force, and the Ringling Brothers actually had published this little pamphlet, this little booklet of do's and don'ts for employees. They regulated their dress. It regulated where they could go, who they could associate with. They had curfews. And the circus world was created on this idea that it was this family-friendly entertainment, especially the big shows. And so they tried to appear wholesome and clean and regulate employee behavior. But I also think that seeing the circus as this mobile company town is just so useful because, you know, how do you separate your work life from your home life when you live on the company train car, or when you sleep next to the elephants that you train, or when every single meal that you take is taken with your coworkers, or your coworkers know your entire family and they see them every day and they feed your child? I think those lines just stay blurred.
You mentioned that there are doctors and vets on the lot. Were there a lot of people injured or killed performing with the circus?
You know, relatively speaking, I feel like the answer is no. It's shocking how many risks people take and how big those risks are, and they walk away every night. But yeah, people did get injured. There, again, was a badge of honor with like working through injuries. You know, the doctor would see people often after their performance. But that threat of death or major injury was always on the job. When I've been telling people, you know, I'm working on the labor history of the circus, it seems like an odd choice, like this unexpected workplace. But for circus workers, they saw themselves as workers and they understood that what they were doing were daily risks associated with a job, you know, with their labor. There are certain risks that they took that were inherent to the circus that weren't in like factories. I mean, they were climbing into a lion cage and could be killed. And some of them were killed in front of thousands of people. There are also these massive tragedies that happened in the circus that scared workers. It really loomed large in the circus world. And train wrecks are one of them, and also fires, tent fires. And they did happen sometimes. And you end up with mass casualties among people and animals, and sometimes even audiences. Audiences were just in such close proximity to this work, to the dangerous stunts, to the dangerous working conditions, that sometimes they end up in the stampede, or they got too close to a caged cat that could swipe its paw. And the individual workers in the big top, they were defying death daily. Some workers spoke as if they were very fatalists. Mabel Stark is one of the cat trainers I profile in the book, and she would say that she knew she would be killed by her cats one day. One of the examples I use in the book is a performer who is very popular, absolutely beloved in the circus world and among fans, and she fell to her death, about 40 feet to her death. And it created this conversation in the circus world, that just this firestorm of talk of some people felt like, how could this happen? How could you not keep this person safe, this performer and celebrity that we love so much? But then so much of the other side of the conversation was that she was a worker and this was just an inherent job risk and she knew the risks of it. And the implication of that line of thinking was that circus workers in general, they knew the risks and they took those risks. And then, of course, surviving significant injuries also created this whole other host of issues that the circus world was confronting about worker care. Workers sometimes were left unable to do physical tasks. And this is the context for the circus world's first benevolent society. It was called the Benevolent Order of the American Tigers. It was like a proto-union, but this was a space where it was after a worker was injured. Workers had some guarantee of disability and funeral expenses. And again, because the thought of death or injury was, I think, constant on the lot.
One of the most interesting chapters to me was called Captive, Coerced, and Frontline Sideshow Workers. Can you elaborate what that means?
Those three kind of subsets of labor, they just existed most prominently in the sideshow. In terms of human labor, this is where those colonial labor networks I talked about were most prominent. There are workers there who sometimes who weren't signing individual labor contracts. We have workers who didn't sign contracts or make money at all. This is a place where managers were signing people together as a group. This is also where you had a lot of the children working on the lot. The entire circus was this democratic amusement where circus goers interacted with their entertainment. They fed elephants, they pet tigers, they were trying to like catch glimpses of performers between the show. But sideshow workers had this additional burden on them. They were interacting very directly with circus goers during the performance. They were face to face. They were talking to people. This was also another stream of income for them, but they were selling these little like trading cards, these little cabinet cards to people. I saw the performance as very frontline, but the sideshow, I think, was also very frontline in terms of just conversations about the shows. For circus proprietors and for circus fans, it was a space where people projected all sorts of expectations about the circus and also critiques about the shows and the workers themselves.
Let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier, a circus celebrity. What kind of worker and who was considered the most important or revered member of the show?
There are the people and the animals, like the tiger I mentioned, who were on the circus posters that we still see today most prominently. They were broadside on sides of buildings. There were circus programs that I talk about in the book. It was a booklet that you would get. There were pages and pages of advertisements. You'd find ads for chewing tobacco, pesticides, cereal, soup, soap, foods. They featured pictures and images of circus workers, the performers, quotes from them. And supposedly they swore by these products. And this is how the show was able to go on. But it was making celebrities out of these workers. They weren't just there for the show. You also could find them in these advertisements. They became these big celebrities. For animals, the biggest animal celebrities, I think sometimes it's difficult to parse out their identity from the identity of their trainers or the people that they worked most closely with. I have a chapter on that relationship between the people and animals. So Jumbo, for example, is one of the biggest animal celebrities ever. But his relationship to his keeper, Matthew Scott, really tied their fates together. And I would argue in the book that it's that working class I talked about, the working class of most of the young men. They were sort of the bedrock of the circus performance. You know, circus goers, they didn't know their individual names, but they definitely came out to see their labor. Circus goers were there to watch the train arrive, to watch it unload, to watch these men and animals create the circus world. And it was just this phenomenal free performance. And I think in all three of those cases, so center ring stars that you would expect that commanded those high paychecks, animals, and then the working class who collected low paychecks, sometimes no paycheck at all, they became celebrities. And it became dangerous or detrimental maybe for the circus management to make celebrities out of those workers, because sometimes they joined unions, sometimes they died tragically, sometimes their labor was too expensive and they were replaced with tractors on the lot. So those sorts of things chipped away at the circus world.
Dr. Ringer, I feel badly asking this next question, but when did the circus fall out of extreme popularity and why?
It's partially because the shows ended that free performance I just talked about. They moved away from the big tops and the trains. This happened in the 1950s. Or they started using pre-recorded music. I think it really was the work. People actually wanted to see labor being performed. And that's what people were attracted to in the shows. I think it's easy to see its cultural demise. And for the larger shows in general, people had incredibly exciting entertainment at home suddenly. So the circus wasn't the biggest thing anymore. But the book traces the way that this demise is that the circus was incapable of keeping up with changes in labor, changes in workplaces. I talk about how the sideshow, for example, it did culturally fall out of favor with most circus goers, but it was state-crafted legislation that forced the shows to reroute over sideshows. The circus was desperately trying to keep a sideshow during those years. But when it did so, interestingly, it spoke in terms of labor. Management spoke about sideshow workers as workers when they were trying to keep them. And they said, if you get rid of sideshows, that you are putting people with disabilities out of work. So it was in terms of labor that the circus was talking about. Dangerous acts also began to fade at that same time. People didn't want to see children falling to their death. But again, the circus was citing insurance premiums being too high. Having to add nets is exciting, and not allowing people to do particular stunts, they said, wasn't as exciting. And then the use of animals changed too. So manual labor really was displaced by tractors and other mechanized forms. That meant the people and the animals who were doing that work weren't there anymore. And it wasn't as exciting to watch a circus show go up. And like I mentioned before, the circus had this steady stream of animals for decades. And they were coming in from places that had been colonized, where colonial hunters were capturing these animals. And so once decolonization took hold, and then you had tighter restrictions around animal importation, the circus was losing access to new animals for its workforce. So I think all those things play a role in the demise.
Well, we all have preconceived notions of what we picture circus workers to look like and act like and be. But through your research, you actually learned about it. Can you tell us about some of those misconceptions about the workers?
About the workers in the workplace itself, I think that the kind of societal consensus is that the circus is just out of step. It's not a modern institution and it's old fashioned, but in the century that the book is examining, it wasn't old fashioned. It was actually incredibly modern. From a labor perspective, they offered circus goers not a peek into the past, although sometimes they did like these big spectacles of like Cleopatra or things like that, but they were constantly advertising themselves as new and cutting edge. They were advertising when they got new lights under the big top. Workers were working under very modern working conditions sometimes. They were selling foods on the lot that people had never had anywhere else, the pink lemonade. And they also had animals that had never been held in captivity like that. And then they had people who were performing physical feats in animals as well that were record breaking. No one had ever seen these things. I also think that the circus wasn't able to pivot as well as zoos into this new image of being conservationists or in favor of animal welfare. And so we see it as so different from other spaces of captivity, of accredited institutions of captivity. But in the book, historically, there's little difference between spaces of captivity for animals. And in fact, circus animals were actually kept at zoos in the winter in some cases. So they're remarkably similar spaces of captivity for animal workers.
A lot of what I read in the book smash the preconceived notions that I have of how the animals were kept and the people as well. The book has 23 incredible black and white photographs. Where did you cull those from? Where did you find such unique and incredible photos?
So that was my favorite part. I saved it for the end, finding the actual photos to use. I was very intentional about them. They come from collections at the Milner Library at Illinois State and also the Robert Parkinson Library at Circus World in Baraboo, Wisconsin. That library is actually at the old Ringling Brothers winter quarters. So it's a very cool space to be in. I didn't want pictures of circus posters. I didn't want centering performances. I didn't want pictures that circus management wanted to project about its workers. I wanted mostly real pictures of workers. So most of the photos are in the backyard, which is this kind of semi-private space that circus workers had. Obviously not completely private because we're looking at photographs of them. The photos are overwhelmingly candid. I have one image under a big top, and that's of Jumbo Skeleton. It was exhibited after his death. It's this stunning photo because it's this huge, vast, kind of mostly empty space. And he's already at this huge elephant occupying the center of the tent. And I included that because I'm kind of trying to grapple with the postmortem displays of workers as well. My favorite photo in the book is there's three people in the photo and it's this really young kid. It's the child of a worker. And they're in the backyard sitting in a high chair next to two performers that the public absolutely fawned over. So it's this kind of candid photo outside of the performance. One of the performers is a clown and the baby is grabbing the clown's nose. I spent a lot of time looking at pictures of kids in the circus world. So there's a few things in the photo that just get me. It's a picture of the high chair. It's the reminder that when you bring your families, you bring everything that comes with, you know, kids and just so much stuff. It's a level of comfort that you can see between these people, including the kid and the adults. And it's also a reminder that kids are so unpredictable. Kids grab people's faces. And I think that that was the circus world, that the circus world was just this unpredictable workplace. Management wanted it to be a machine and to be efficient in that way, but they employed kids and they employed animals, and sometimes they employed disgruntled adults. And I think that unpredictable nature of the work is what you can see in these pictures. And I think it's what made the show so popular.
If somebody wants to find out about your work, whether it's circus related or otherwise, where can they go to find out additional information or reach you?
So my up-to-date teaching and research bio is on my Tennessee State University faculty page. You can find some of my articles that intersect with this history and the history of other interspecies workplaces in a few journals. I talked about labor. Also in gender and history, I have an article.
Dr. Andrea Ringer's Circus World, Roustabouts, Animals, and the World of Putting on the Big Show is available at illinoispress.edu. Dr. Andrea Ringer, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.